Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, senior writer at Rolling Stone, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. I also have Nathan Brackett here from Rolling Stone.
What's up, Brian? Week two.
This is week two of our live show here on Sirius XM. We have, again, some really great guests today. The TV soundtracks, TV scores and soundtracks is not something I've given a lot of thought to. I can't remember the last one that jumped out at me. Do you remember the last one that jumped? Cop Rock, right?
Maybe Cop Rock. Yeah. Grey's Anatomy? Yeah. I don't know. Nothing, you know?
Right.
Nothing.
Well, the OC, you know?
Yeah.
But that was, Luke Cage, which is a show that debuted not long ago on Netflix from Marvel, has one of the greatest scores and also soundtracks, original music and existing music, that I've just ever heard on a TV show.
This one is super special.
Yeah, it creates a whole world, and it creates this world of a superhero in Harlem. And we have with us today the people behind that music. Adrian Young, an amazing producer, and Ali Shaheed Muhammad of Tribe Called Quest and many other things, and they collaborated and made this music, and we're so happy to have them. You there, guys?
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing?
Thanks so much for being here. We're in New York and they're in LA, so we cannot actually see them, but it sounds like we're all in the same place, hopefully, so that's good.
The magic
we're supposed
radio.
To fake. We're supposed to fake it, though. You just messed up
man,
the illusion.
We didn't get the memo. We're like print guys. Oh, we didn't get that. Oh, damn.
No, I don't believe in faking. I think we have to be real.
All right, transparency.
Yeah, full transparency. Yeah.
We're super excited to have you guys.
Right, so if we're going to be real, I'm actually in the bathroom on myself.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding.
Too real.
Just kidding.
we've gone too far. We have so much to talk about the amazing music on the show and about each of your careers. But there is breaking news, and I wish we had sort of like a breaking news bell to ring. Ali, you know, obviously last night it was announced that there is going to be a new Tribe Called Quest album.
Yeah, we just got to get this out of the way and talk about this for a little bit.
I was hoping you'd save that to the very, very end, but yes, announcement has been made.
And basically, we figured we'd flip it. We'll get it out of the way, you know, just very quickly and just, you know, within the limits of our time here, just how did this come together? What should we expect from it? How much of Fife were we able to get on this album? What's the deal?
Oh, man, you know, I really wasn't prepared to talk about this, but I will say, as Q-Tip had posted in his handwritten note that nearly a year ago, we performed on the Fallon show, and he felt the way about the performance that inspired him to want to do another record, and that night he called us up and said, come, could you stay in New York a little while longer? And I have this idea. And so I could not because I was working on Luke Cage. But definitely inspired Fife to stick around. And there's quite a deal of Fife Dawg on there.
That's incredible.
It's a new Tribe Called Quest record. You know, people have been asking for it for a long time. And there were many points in times when we didn't think it would happen, but you will have it November 11th.
That's amazing news. And this is the first one in 18 years? Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, I had to think about that. Yeah.
That's amazing news. It is. We can't wait to hear it.
This is just calmly. You guys have broken the news because I don't know who Q-Tip has spoken with about it, but yeah, this is the first time he posted that note last night.
Yeah.
Everyone's been asking me in the Luke Cage campaign about it, and I just would not talk about it.
I know
it.
You
so
couldn't
here
talk
you go,
about
Brian
it.
And Nathan. Boom.
We had to ambush you on this. We had no choice.
We figured it was cool now that it was announced, but you know, and maybe we'll return to that very briefly at the end. But so Luke Cage. You guys were working on another project together. It's called Midnight Hour, correct?
Yeah.
And what was the deal with that? And that preceded Luke Cage, I believe.
Well, Ali had worked with me and Souls of Mischief on an album that we created a few years back called There's Only Now. Hmm. And, I enjoyed working with Ali so much. And, you know, I've always been a fan of his works that I was like, let's if we had this much fun doing this project, let's just do something brand new. So we started the project, and you know, we worked on some other things, and then while we were wrapping up the project, we got the opportunity to potentially score this upcoming black comic television series called Luke Cage. And it was one of those things that was just so good, like too good to be true, that we both said, basically, if this actually comes into fruition, we got to put this album on hold. And it came into fruition, and we put the album on hold, and we just picked the album up again to start finishing. And that'll be ready for the top of next year.
Yeah, I mean, there's a track on the Kendrick Lamar album, Untitled mm-hmm. 6, that mm-hmm. was actually supposed to be a track on Midnight Hour and still will be with CeeLo, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Kendrick caught wind of what we were doing and really liked that song. So on Kendrick's album, he is using the demo version to create a whole full new derivative song. And unbeknownst to him, we had actually finished the entire song. So there's going to be basically two versions of this song, which is called Untitled 6 on there, but the original title is actually Question Marks. So we're really looking forward to having people hear that. Nice. Should be special.
Nice. Actually, let's listen to the Kendrick song for 1 second.
These metamorphic supernatural forces dominate what I see. A Gemini duality, personalities always conflicted.
Man, that I wish we could listen to the whole thing. It's awesome. You guys, so one of the many interesting things about Luke Cage is that the showrunner has his own background as a music writer. Talk about
we know Cheo Kettley, who's a former Rolling Stone contributor, now probably doing a little better monetarily than some of our contributors of record reviews. But he called you guys separately, right?
Yes, he reached out to us separately. And first, I just want to say, let that be an incentive to all you other
thanks for the pep talk,
contributors and journalists out there to be you.
He is our superhero. He is our Luke Cage.
And same for us as well, indeed. But Cheo, I've known Cheo for a long time, and he reached out to me for Luke Cage, and he reached out to Adrian as well. And like we mentioned before, we were working together on the Midnight Hour, so it was pretty dope that that's what he wanted for this series, is to merge our sounds together. And so we met with Cheo, we met with the heads of Marvel Television, and we had a job interview. And
probably something you haven't had to do a lot of in your career. Yeah.
You always have to have it. I mean,
get together.
The get together, absolutely. And so he told us what he wanted, and we gave him our thoughts on how we could make his initial idea more sensational. And part of that was to record with a 30-piece orchestra. Mm. And so we composed our music, and then we give it to our orchestrator and conductor, Miguel Atwood Ferguson. And that's pretty much how it all came together. So
how did he define his original concept for the music of the show?
Hip hop based. It was kind of a back and forth between an era, you know, like mid 90s, sort of golden era age of hip hop and sound. But mostly just something that kind of came from the breakbeat part of hip hop, when everyone was sampling and doing breaks before it became super computery and electronic-y. Just going back to the source music of like certain jazz and funk and soul records. And so, but maintaining that head nod thump, sort of a melodic, hypnotizing aspect that hip hop tends to have.
Mm. And you guys definitely delivered like the hip hop element, but as you were saying, like the stuff that the real source material stuff that you guys deliver, like the some of the Blaxploitation era stuff or stuff that recalls like Ennio Morricone is just amazing. I mean, this is just I can't like overstate like how cool like some of this soundtrack music is. Like this is just like an album you can actually is an album you can just like put on.
Yeah, well actually let's play the opening theme. It's just the one that's called Theme, Alex. You know, I'm feeling bulletproof already. That's obviously it's such a short piece of music, but it has to accomplish so much. So how did you kind of get to there?
Well, that was actually our third take at the theme, and our second take at the theme is actually the song you hear that is called the end theme.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't know this, but that end theme. There was a big fight as to whether the end theme is going to be the actual theme for the show. So there was one side that loved the what is now called the theme, and one side that loved what is now called the end theme.
Should we play the end theme,
which I had ready too, because it was funny. I think I almost like the end theme even better. So let's hear that. Let's hear that.
Set it off.
That is just some crazy, like, Isaac Hayes, like, hot buttered soul. Yeah. Like, that is awesome.
Well, the end theme, so like I said, there were two camps, and because I guess the teams reached a point of impasse, just one was chosen as the first theme and one was chosen as the end theme. But as far as the end theme, musically, you know, I personally like the end theme better than the first. I love the first theme. I love it all, but the end theme... It's taking more of a chance because if you listen to theme songs, a lot of times there's a request for the song to be faster because it is generally thought that if a song is faster, it's more impactful if the tempo's faster.
Huh.
But that's really not true. When you could have a song that just hits in a certain way and moves through chords, it kind of takes the listener on a journey. That's maybe why the end theme resonates with you a little bit more, because it resonates with me a little bit more on musically, but nevertheless, I mean, I'm still a fan of the theme, you know. But
the main theme, I think one of the things when I first heard it and the wah wah guitars came in, I was like, huh, that's a little on the nose, a little like a direct Blaxploitation kind of reference, but I love it. So I don't know what you're thinking.
You know what's crazy, and this is something that I say a lot. A lot of people, when they listen to this, they think of it as they get Blaxploitation out of it, right?
Right.
But the reason why a lot of people get Blaxploitation out of it is that you don't hear a lot of unapologetically Black music being used as score for television and or film right now that's played with an orchestra and with live instruments.
That's a great
so
point.
the last time there was a genre of that kind of music being used to enhance the visual is during the 70s. That's the last time. But if you listen to a lot of modern music, whether it's Black, white, whatever, there's wah-wah guitars all over it.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Right.
But the thing is, because you're not used to hearing it, you automatically think Blaxploitation, which is actually true. But it just shows that there is a void of this type of soulful music being heard, because it's something that is if you're going like waka 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 waka, that's something that really, really is a 70s thing.
Yeah.
But just using wah when you're playing like a lead and all that stuff, that's all. That's in rock. That's in everything.
Totally.
But you don't hear it. You don't hear it soulfully like this, and it just automatically takes you back. To that time, and I would be just like you if I heard this too. I would say the same thing. So
totally,
but it's just something to note.
No, I think that's important. And we're gonna take a break, and we're gonna be right back with Ali Sheehy Muhammad and Adrian Young talking about the amazing music of Luke Cage. This is Rolling Stone Music Now.
you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Macy's, Adidas, Walmart, Nike, Wine.com, Samsung, Lenovo, Sephora, and more. And even stack sales on top of cashback. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Our house is a mess. Come on in. I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
So guys, I mean, in general, we were just talking about influences. I mean, what were some of the influences that you were drawing on to create this very specific world of music for the show?
We were drawing on the likes of Wu-Tang, Curtis Mayfield, Isaac Hayes, Ennio Morricone, Bernard Herrmann. Marvin Gaye, James Brown, a lot of different artists.
And it seems like there was an overall idea I've seen in other interviews. You really wanted to embrace the idea of this is, you've called the music unapologetically black. You were trying to remind people of what could be done in the context of scoring in a black musical context, which has been done before, but isn't done enough. That was definitely something on your mind, it sounds like.
Well, definitely there's a couple of things. In television, as you mentioned earlier, and not really recalling a television score that you think of that you cared about. When you said that, I instantly thought of Hawaii Five-0, Good Times. Definitely the 70s era. Things seem to be more musical. And nowadays, there's a tendency to have things be very synthetic and atmospheric to support emotion and the feeling and the movement of what's seen on the screen. And we wanted to make a statement that, especially because Chael wanted it to have such a hip-hop flair, we wanted it to be that, but also great composition to be, as you said earlier, something that you can listen independently of the series, but not with the intention of make that departure, but just to have the music to be that good, which means thinking more about it and not being so simple as to dial up a template of something that's tension based. And which is a tendency to happen. If you listen to a lot of television shows, there's a lot of similarities in the background music. And so we wanted it to really, the music to lead the emotion or help to support the emotion in a way that people have not been doing for a long time.
I wanted to ask about Requiem for Fife. Which obviously, worked in the context of the show in a very powerful way, I think episode 8, and then obviously has another very powerful meaning, and it's also a very beautiful piece of music. How did the idea to be able to get that in and the actual composition of that piece work?
I had received a text message from Fife while we were recording the orchestra for, I think it was episode 6 and 7, and just right after that, we had to go into scoring episode 8. And there's a particular scene in that episode that has a mournful feel to it, and I'm not going to give away the scene.
No spoilers.
But yeah. But for those who've seen it, or if you will see it, you'll understand. And so when we actually recorded the orchestra for that piece was the night before Fife passed.
Wow.
I mean, the night after Fife passed. And so it was, our orchestra days are pretty fun because we have a lot of people that come in, and we want people to feel the experience of hearing strings and brass and woodwinds. It's such an experience. And so we have a lot of people come in the studio, and that particular day I was just kind of in and out, just a lot going through my head after, you know, just dealing with the news that my brother was no longer here.
Yeah.
And when I walked into the room, they were actually cutting to that song, and the entire room just had this feeling. And I tended that was always the case with the orchestra days, but that one in particular. And then it dawned on me what scene it was. It was often Adrian and I are working at such a fast pace. We write something and we kind of forget what it goes to, what part it goes to. And so instantly it hit me which scene that was, and it just seemed like he was talking to me.
Wow. Let's hear a little bit of that. Wow. That is a beautiful and intense piece of music. On the other end of things, you, Adrian, was it your joint responsibility to for the existing music, the existing hip hop and other music that was played in the show? You were the music supervisor. Is that how that worked?
No, we were the composers. There's Netflix create one of the first promo videos dealing with the music of the show had us erroneously listed as music supervisors.
That's why I think that.
So yeah. And it's funny because that came out. Well, that came out, and then, you know, we saw it, and I didn't even notice it, right? And then
I bet the music supervisor noticed it though, right?
Probably. Yeah, probably. So then I'm seeing a bunch of articles pop up, and we're called music supervisor. I'm like, man, these people are bad journalists. They're not even doing their due diligence. And then we realized that there was a mistake of us being listed as music supervisors. So the actual music supervisors on the show were Season Kent and Gabe Hilfer, and they did one hell of a job picking the music along with Cheo Coker, who's the showrunner,
right,
as we spoke of earlier. So they all pretty much combined as a team to pick all the needle drops and to help, you know, just illuminate the world of Luke Cage through music.
I think people are ready to believe that you guys supervised it because it all flows so seamlessly, but I just mean that everyone did their job.
Team effort.
And before we go into a break, the one of the cool original songs was Bulletproof Love, which you guys did work on.
Yes.
Yeah. How did that come together?
Cheo, throughout the series, he has featured guest artists. So there's Raphael Sadiq, there's Charles Brightley, there's Sharon Jones, Faith Evans, Jordana, who else? Ton of people, the Delphonics. And so he specifically wanted, it's funny, he has such a wish list on certain aspects of the show, and one of them was to get somebody in from a Wu. And so he had this idea about Method Man, and it was supposed to feature Method Man as experiencing and interacting with Luke. And so then he comes and does the Sway Show and rhymes about, I guess, you know, freestyle about what happened.
So we
created the song.
It's cool. I mean, it's good to know that both Sway and Meth Man exist in the Marvel Universe. That's a good fact to know. So, guys, I want to talk a little bit about the development of your styles. Ali, I mean, Tribe, when the very unique and now sort of historic and iconic and important style of production that you had on those records, How did it come together? What were the influences, and what felt fresh to you at that time?
Well, certainly not doing with what other people were doing, and we had a lot of respect for, like, the Bomb Squad and Marley Marl. You know, the Bomb Squad's style of production, they mashed up a lot of little bit itty bitty sounds and captured a lot of just different breaks and pieces, and made this crazy mashup composition of greatness. And then for a lot of other songs that at that time was just a lot of James Brown samples, and I think a lot of things that you would definitely absolutely find in your parents' record collection. But Q-Tip's dad introduced him to jazz, and Tip introduced me to jazz music. And not the cool jazz of the time of the 80s, but, you know, the more straight stuff of the 60s and 70s. And just, I guess, you know, just digging in the crates from that perspective, and really loving the open breaks that you would find on the jazz records. It was different than the funk breaks and the soul breaks. They were very melodic. And so, and the music moved, you know, just, even if it was a simple 4-bar loop, it just felt like it had movement. And the way that the Bomb Squad would layer sounds that became musical, or more rhythmic, I should say. Not
right.
Music, rhythmic.
Sort of noises, percussion kind of stuff. Yeah, but yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so we layered other clips or samples, pieces of one jazz record, and put it on top of another, so there could be a, you know, like the Benita Applebaum, for example, that one particular record, that one loop goes on and on. But then what makes the record interesting is the sitar that comes out of nowhere, which is not part of that original song that we sampled. So it's just doing things like that. And it hadn't really been done at the time. And so it was fresh, I guess, and people still love it.
Yeah, and Adrian, it was a major influence on you. Low End Theory was one of the most important albums for you, I believe.
Absolutely. I always tell Ali and that, you know, Tribe introduced me to jazz. Tribe really made me appreciate and love jazz. And also, that album is one of the first to serve as a seminal example of how to intertwine samples with real musical composition, not just merely arrangement and production, because they used instruments with the samples. They blended samples in ways that were in key. And this was something that was brand new. And they also, with this album, showed us all a new way to reinterpret the bottom end, the low end of the musical spectrum as far as hip hop is concerned. So it definitely inspired me. And you could hear that stuff in my music. You could hear that stuff on the Luke Cage soundtrack as far as the root of inspiration.
I think we might.
And it's not just me. I always tell people that, you know, with all my affiliations in hip hop, to me, Tribe is still my favorite.
I think we might have to listen to a little bit of Low End Theory. Should we put on a little bit?
1988, senior year at Garvey High, where all the guys were corny, but the girls were mad fly. Lounging with the tipster, cooling with shop, scoping out the honeys. They know who they are.
Man, things really do go in cycles, because we're hearing jazz as a major part of hip hop again in the last couple of years, which is incredible. And quite frankly, I never thought we'd get back there. So
definitely. Like with Kendrick Lamar's exactly. album, you know, with Robert Glasper, who was a jazz artist who was influenced by hip hop and Dilla, and how he brought it around. you know. So
definitely. And Kamasi Washington, of course.
Kamasi Washington. Yeah. Terrace Martin, yeah.
But Adrian, I understand that you've said that you actually, it's kind of funny because you're producing hip hop in the last few years, but you've said that you kind of stopped listening to hip hop around 1998. I'm sure that's not literal, perhaps not literally true, but what do you mean when you say that and why?
Well, I'm somebody that is an avid member of what I define as a hip hop culture, and that raised me. Now, I always tell people that I actually left hip hop in 97, because to me that's around the time when the music didn't reflect the culture as much. The music tended to, at that time, started to become a lot more pop oriented.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just not made for the B-boys and the B-girls. Or let me rephrase. The vantage point of making music for the underground and the culture, and a culture of people that speak the same vernacular, have the same feelings. You know, those decades to me were coming to an end in 97. And this is with the advent of hip-hop really getting into R&B and changing what R&B is, and uh-huh. vice versa. And the radio starting to accept hip-hop a lot more, which is not bad. That's actually really great. But what it did was really created, to me, a really uncultivated market of rap music that was just around to try to make people dance. And so, you know, from 97 to now, obviously there's a lot of great hip-hop still being made. But a lot of that hip-hop is not stuff you really hear on the radio. It's stuff you have to actually search and find in the underground, you know, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But at that time also is when I really got into just DJing and listening to old breaks and records. And I also discovered that those records meant more to me than the hip-hop derivatives that were made from sampling these records.
What kind of records are we talking about here?
That's when I started getting into listening to Curtis Mayfield, into Ennio Morricone. I mean, basically, I was listening to the source material of hip-hop, the breaks, and deconstructing how they created these compositions, why is it that those drums sound so good? How, you know, why does the bass sound so mid-rangey and punchy? Why don't people make music like this anymore? But then when I play this kind of music for people, they have the same reaction that I do. And that kind of inspired my foundation to make music with this patina.
Totally.
And that's when, to me, it's just that music was just, I mean, like I said, I'm a person of the hip-hop culture, but at that moment, I started to realize that I actually like that music better than hip-hop, and hip-hop led me to it.
Wow. That's Final Battle, part one. You know, it's a final battle, but that's part one of the final battle. When you think about the big superhero battle, that's not necessarily what you've been hearing in superhero movies the last few years, but look what you guys did with it. So tell us about that piece a little bit, what you remember about it coming together.
That was something that was probably one of the toughest parts of the score, actually, now that I think about it, mm-hmm. right? Because the fight scene, we had to score.
It's like an 14 minutes.
It's like 14 minutes. So it was just a lot of musical movements within. You know, you can't have when you're scoring, you don't generally, especially for something like 14 minutes, you don't score nonstop. You have to take the viewer with you. So there's ups and downs, and the music has to reflect those ups and downs in a way that doesn't expose what is about to happen. So yeah. it was pretty difficult, but we wanted to have a take on it that was unorthodox. We didn't want to fall into the general
thunder shaking bass,
exactly.
Exactly. That's what, like, it totally, that's what really jumped out at me listening to it, and also just listening to it as a piece of music on like Spotify. It's like you going back to what you were saying before, we are so used to, as listeners, to action movies with just certain canned things, and like, oh, okay, this is the battle scene, this is what the battle scene sounds like, and hearing something that's so fresh and just so different, it just really changes the whole experience so much.
Go ahead.
Well, one thing about this experience is that this is something that Ali and I have always wanted to do for something of this magnitude. And the reason why we were granted the authority to do it is because not only the creator, Chao Coker, believed in us, but Netflix and Marvel believed in our vision. And that inspired us and pushed us to try to really essentially dedicate 9 months of our lives to just trying to create the best score ever for television. I mean, we dropped everything for this.
Yeah, it took over your lives, right? You didn't really anticipate how much it would, I think.
I did.
Okay.
I kept trying to tell Adrian. I was like, I don't think you...
It's true.
Because Adrian, and he's done this before, and with Black Dynamite, not only, you know, scoring it, but editing it, he has... you know, inside look as to what is necessary to get the job done. But for me, it was my first time, and I felt like that nothing else could exist. And Adrian usually is like, oh, we can do it all, and he's usually like 99.9% right about that, you know, in life. But with this particular thing, at some point, it was funny. I don't remember when, but he said to me, yo, you're right.
Like, yep.
we can't go anywhere, we can't do anything but this, and I'm like, yeah, man. So but it was a sacrifice, and we both would do it all over again, because we knew the type of impact that we wanted to have. And in order to do that, you have to have vision, you have to have faith and belief, and having the support, as he said, of Marvel, and Netflix was definitely a key component of that. And so, knowing after we submitted the first we submitted episode number 2 first in scoring, and the feedback we got from both Marvel and Netflix let us know that we were in an environment that was going to allow us to just take it to the heights musically and be innovative against what is normally heard on television. And so we committed.
You mentioned Bernard Herrmann, Cottonmouth's theme, which we'll play in a second. But that, I think that one kind of showed that influence. Bernard Herrmann, I guess Psycho and everything. So was that someone you were thinking about in that intense little piece of music?
Well, that is actually yes, absolutely. It's definitely analogous to a lot of the Bernard Herrmann. But what really inspired that was how Tarantino used Quincy Jones' Ironside. How it's the use of those synthesizers, and you hear a lot of that kind of score and composition in a lot of old kung fu movies as well. Just wild, raging octave-based synthesizers. So, that was our nod to say, like, "Yo, Tarantino, what up, bro? Like, what we gonna do? What's cracking? That's for you. That's for you."
So the other thing that's cool is the way music infuses so many aspects of the show, and a brilliant little detail that Chao did is that Cottonmouth, the villain, is a frustrated musician. So there's these scenes of him just cooling out with like a Fender Rhodes, I think, right? And just and you have to establish that he actually is talented. So who played that stuff for real?
That was me and Ali. There's one scene where we brought in one of our good musician friends,
Darian,
to play something. But on most of those, it's Ali and I playing the roads. And then what's funny about those scenes is Mahershala, who plays Cottonmouth, would literally. Well, we had to create the piano riffs,
right?
and send it over because they would be shooting like in a day or two. So we had to create the riffs and then also videotape ourselves playing it and send that as well. So Mahershala would have, you know, a couple hours just to kind of try to figure it out. And he did a hell of a job.
He sure did, because it wasn't intentional to make it challenging, but we wanted it to be real. And we could have written something that was real easy for him to play on camera. But knowing the musicianship of his character, mm-hmm. we really wanted the music to be authentic and yep. challenging. And so...
And deliver some emotion, right?
Yes, absolutely. And so Mahershala didn't back away from that, you know.
And you're listening to Rolling Stone Music Now in Volume, and we have a couple more minutes with the composers of the music of Luke Cage on Netflix. Guys, it seems like your partnership has to go forward from here, whether it's on season two, which I know everyone's asking about, but if I were you, I'd be holding out for Riz.
But, we can help you negotiate some of that.
Yeah. Let's do it right now.
You need us. Yeah.
But I would imagine this has cemented you two as a team, I hope, going forward, you know, in addition to all the other stuff you'd be doing separately.
Oh, I mean, we've already cemented, you know, but definitely going through this process, it just, we learn more about what we're able to do, and we're excited to do those things, you know, together. And we have a whole lot of ideas, and just trying to find the right outlets to get them out.
And Adrian, has Ali played you the Tribe album?
No, actually.
What?
Not
what?
Really my friend. No, we heard a lot of it when we were at Tips. Like, what was that?
January, February.
Probably like January, February. It's great. It's great to hear you know, my favorite hip hop group have new music. It's a really special thing, because I've always studied why my favorite artist fell off, right? And Tribe never fell off. They were always great. So in listening to it, I'm just in my mind just hoping that they don't fall off like Isaac Hayes did to me or Curtis Mayfield did to me. And these people are icons, you know.
Yeah.
And it's great. They did a good job.
I mean, Ali, as we wrap up, I mean, what was it like to try to craft a modern sound, and to try to live up to, this is the kind of thing I end up asking reunited rock bands all the time, you know, like, how do you live up to your old stuff, you know? What was that challenge like, and especially in the face of the tragedy that's hanging over this album?
That's a challenging question to answer, and I'll just answer it this way, that because I was working on Luke Cage and in a concentrated way, there was limitations on what I could contribute to the Tribe Called Quest record. And however, my major contribution was to inspire Fife to continue, because at many different points he wanted to do something different. And I thought that both he and Q-Tip being in the room together, more so for their friendship, surpasses anything that they could do in recording. And I don't know why I felt that way, and I continue to encourage him to just deal with the discomforts of his traveling and having to be away from home in his condition. And I did not know that he wouldn't be here, you know? It could have gone a different way. I mean, I could have just said something different. I'm like, okay, go home,
Yeah.
You know,
but we're so glad you did, right?
Yeah. And not just because, again, not because of the music, but because, I mean, everyone has seen the documentary and have seen, you know, the challenges between everyone, just brotherhood. And they were able to spend so much time together.
Yeah.
And at this period. So the reward for everyone else is that there's an album.
And that's it for this episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. Thanks very much to our guests, Adrian Young and Ali Shaheed Muhammad. Tune in to SiriusXM's Volume every Friday at 1 p.m. for the live show. Subscribe to Rolling Stone Music Now at rollingstone.com/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. See you next week.